History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it before it's too late, and if they're allowed to talk about it, which is relevant to today's episode. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do that, we end up educated. We always are entertained. And if we're listening closely enough, I think we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Over the last two decades, we have met quite a few veterans who have seemed to be deserving of greater decorations than they received. Seeing that long overdue or just overlooked recognition actually come about is a pretty rare occasion. And even more odds are defied when it happens while a veteran is still with us. But that actually happened this week during the State of the Union Address. When I first had the privilege of meeting Royce Williams 10 years ago, he had just begun discussing something kept secret for more than 60 years. We're going to hear some of what he shared that day in a bit. But here's what the President of the United States had to say about him in Washington, D.C. this past week.
Tonight we've celebrated many truly extraordinary American patriots, but there is one last living legend to honor before we go. He is one more heroic American aviator, Navy fighter pilot. Royce Williams served in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, flying more than 220 missions. In the skies over Korea in 1952, Royce was in the dogfight of a lifetime, legendary dogfight, flying through blizzard conditions. His squadron was ambushed by seven Soviet fighter planes. It was his first aerial combat of the war, and despite being massively outnumbered and outgunned, Royce led the takedown of four enemy jets and almost destroyed the others, vanquishing his adversaries while taking 263 bullets to his own plane and being seriously hurt. His story was secret for over 50 years. He didn't even want to tell his wife, but the legend grew and grew. But tonight, at 100 years old, this brave Navy captain is finally getting the recognition he deserves. He was a legend long before this evening. Royce, please stand up, and I will ask the First Lady of the United States to present Captain Royce Williams with his Congressional Medal of Honor.
It was about the longest ovation possible, and boy, was it a long time coming. When we first met Royce Williams in 2016, it wasn't in the halls of Congress, but a much different setting, a Denny's restaurant in Oceanside, California, at a gathering of a group called the Old Bold Pilots. At that point, Royce had not been decorated at all for his heroics in 1952 because his mission had remained veiled in secrecy for decades. He had just been featured in a magazine under the headline, The Forgotten Hero of the Forgotten War. But of course, we started out our conversation the way we try to begin with all the veterans we get to meet on Hometown Heroes. I asked him about his early years, growing up during the Great Depression in South Dakota.
Freedom. My parents didn't worry about where I was, and I had friends, and we would go out from the small town and dam up a little creek and make a swimming pool or a swimming hole. We played cowboys and Indians, and a lot of excitement and good pals.
Do you remember, even at that young of an age, having any ambitions or thoughts about what you might do in the future?
Oh, yes. Anytime an airplane came by, we were all heads up. Sometimes it would land on a field a mile or so out of town, and we would run all the way to be there. My brother, likewise, who's a retired Marine colonel, naval aviator, but when I was about eight, in our discussions, he wanted to be a naval aviator, I wanted to be a naval aviator, so our goal was set.
Why the Navy for flying as opposed to the old Army Air Corps?
I don't know. It must have been a movie or something.
Got you hooked. And your brother was older or younger?
Year and a half older.
So did he get in first?
Yes, 6 months ahead of me.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Because everybody I've talked to who was alive back then seems to remember something.
I remember exactly. I was roller skating out in front of the store. My dad used his World War I bonus to buy a storefront, and he, being a carpenter and everything else he could do, built a residence behind it. And I was out there, and he said, Royce and Lynn, come on in. And it was the president on announcing Pearl Harbor. And I sat down in front of the radio and listened word by word.
Did that rock your world a little bit?
Oh, yes. Yes, because shortly after that, we signed up.
You both signed up at the same time, you and your brother?
No, I think I signed up first with the Minnesota Guard, and he went on to become a machinist at an outlet of the University of Minnesota at Morris, Minnesota. And then after a short period of that, he signed on.
So you wanted to get over there and do something about what was going on in the world, huh?
I thought I owed it. My dad believed in it. He was a machine gunner in World War I.
Wow. So the family legacy was there. Yes. And as far, I know we want to get to Korea and your incredible story from 1952, but as far as what you did for the rest of World War II, training to become a naval...
Exhibitions.
While you were in high school?
Yeah.
You were doing the aerobatics?
No, I was just going along for the ride.
Oh, okay.
Sell tickets, wipe the airplane down, and fly whenever I could.
That's a good job.
Yeah, it was. And so my early training was in an open cockpit, Navy-built N3N out of a pasture in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, a lot of academics and athletics in the cadet training program. And the next level was, again, in open cockpit steerman out of Memphis. And then gradually into single-wing, low, and eventually even retractable landing gear. So I finally got through, as the war was ending, I got extended and extended because they could see that the pipeline of pilots coming in was meeting the need plus.
Mm-hmm.
So I flew the SBD Dauntless as a aviation cadet, and then I went into fighters, Hellcats and Corsairs and Bearcats and on and on.
And what about your brother during World War II?
Yes, pretty much the same thing. He did his training out of Yankton, South Dakota initially, and Minneapolis, Iowa pre-flight. And he chose the Marine route on commissioning, and he was deployed on the Bedoying Strait and in the Battle of Okinawa.
Ah, so he got in at the tail end.
Yes.
But he made it home from the war.
He did. He stayed on, and in his last assignment as a colonel on Admiral McCain's staff in Hawaii, I relieved him. He retired the next day and went into the swimming pool business.
Smart man. As for you, when World War II came to an end and you hadn't made it overseas, was there any kind of disappointment on your part that you didn't personally get over there?
Well, there was, but I realized I made the effort, and the rest was Navy program. I fulfilled it.
And I'm sure you didn't want another war. I mean, here there was a war to end all wars, and it's finally over, and America and its allies have won. But just a few years later, Korea crops up. What do you remember about getting deployed during that time period?
Well, I made several deployments right after the war. I was over there on the Princeton and got into Nagasaki shortly after the bomb hit there. And I came back, and I made regular Navy, so they sent me to the University of Minnesota since I was just a high school grad, and they wanted all their officers to have at least 2 years of college. So they sent me for a year and a half, and I got a four-year degree. Then they sent me on to Monterey School.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, the war was on, and I wondered, why not me? Well, my time came up, and I went. Yes, I was more or less anxious to get in on it. And due course, Navy assignments, I finally got there.
And I'm sorry for bouncing around here, but you mentioned Nagasaki right after the bomb hit.
Yes.
There aren't too many people around today who saw what you saw there, experienced mm-hmm. that. What did you see, and what did it do to you?
Well, I knew just about everything I needed to know about it. Seeing kind of magnified it. It was a vast, level area where a lot of manufacturing had been, and the really only thing rising much above ground level were smokestacks that were circular reinforced steel cement as we're standing. But at the north end of the city, there was a rise of hills, and their commercial part of town and a lot of residents were on the other side of this hill, and the pressure from the bomb just went up and over them, and it was maintained. Probably got some gamma rays or something, but was not in any way molested.
Mm-hmm. Was it just as a human being to see that there was something capable of that? Was that something that kind of changed your perspective a little?
I think I grew up with it about as early as anybody knew about it. When I was stationed on exchange duty with the Air Force over at Nellis, and they were doing a lot of testing during the time.
Mm.
And I'd be notified that it'd be 4 o'clock in the morning, the family would get up and watch the sky light up. I went through Aniwetok at about the time they were doing the testing there and saw all of the ships assemble. And I became a weapons delivery officer later on.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the nuclear age.
I guess so. And this caption I read earlier, the forgotten hero of the forgotten war, the Korean War, is often forgotten, often overlooked. And you did something in that war that I'm sure you never planned on, that you probably didn't see coming. But November 18th, 1952, what can you tell us about what happened that day?
Well, the Navy carrier force was fully involved in basically operating at the 38th parallel, the division of North and South Korea, and our mission was air to ground, of protecting our troops and destroying enemy trains and trucks and supply lines, tunnels and so forth. And we were not engaged with the MiGs. That was a separate war going on with the Air Force to see who could get the big headlines. But they decided that some of the factories that we should be destroying were beyond our range from there, so they moved a task force of 3 carriers and probably 20-some other ships closer to the Yalu, the river that divides Soviet Union and North Korea. And I was on the first raid pre-dawn and hitting at dawn on a city called Horyong. Our targets were manufacturing sites and warehouses.
It's time for our first break, but we'll pick up his incredible and long-buried story when we come back. America's latest recipient of the Medal of Honor, now 100-year-old Royce Williams. More of his words, as well as some of the laudatory words directed his way in the Pentagon's Hall of Heroes this week. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing.
over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties, and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, spotlighting America's latest recipient of our nation's highest military decoration, the Medal of Honor. The day after Royce Williams had that medal hung around his neck by the First Lady, he was also the focus of a special ceremony at the Pentagon's Hall of Heroes. The invocation there was delivered by Rear Admiral Kerry Cash, the chaplain of the Marine Corps.
Almighty God, whose spirit hovers over the waters, commands the storm, and illumines the burning blue of the sky, into your hands we commend the hero we honor today, Captain Royce Williams. For bringing his long-hidden heroism to light, O God, we are thankful. Our nation's highest honor, the Medal of Honor, proclaims a grateful nation and a debt to those few who demonstrate uncommon valor. O God, we praise the character of this man. In an age often bereft of virtue, we acknowledge his fidelity, his love for country, for his wife and family, and his faithfulness to you. O God, bless and spread abroad the example of Captain Williams, who on a day of battle long ago, in dark skies over a threatened land, did himself meet the enemy with courage and resolve. To the very edge of doom he flew. He fought for his fellow pilots in the air, for the nation who sent him, for the Navy he loved, for the soldiers and Marines on the ground, and for a cherished way of life that is the inheritance of all free peoples. As we celebrate this honor bestowed upon your servant, may we do more than venerate, but Lord, help us imitate. With the little time we have, help us imitate that sacrificial spirit that Captain Williams demonstrated on that heroic day and throughout all of his life. Oh God, bless Royce, and pour out upon him all grace, that even now he might be given the strength to fight the good fight and finish his race in the sure and certain hope that the God who calls sustains. For we know that the one who trusts in the Lord, to him is promised a crown of life, eternal and imperishable, where moth and rust cannot destroy and thieves cannot break in and steal. This is your reward, O God, and the highest honor of all. Well done, Captain Williams. Well done. Hear the words of your God and great commander. Well done, my good and faithful servant. Amen.
Rear Admiral Kerry Cash's invocation at the Hall of Heroes ceremony inside the Pentagon this week for Royce Williams, now 100 years old. He was just 90 when he shared his story on Hometown Heroes a decade ago. At that point, he had never been decorated for his secret heroics against Soviet fighter planes during the Korean War. In 2023, he was finally given the Navy Cross, but as of this week, that has been upgraded to the absolute pinnacle, the Medal of Honor. Here's what Royce told us in 2016 about that unforgettable day, November 18th, 1952.
I was flying a Panther, an F-9F-5.
And a lot of people aren't familiar with that plane. They know the ones before it and after it. But what was unique about that plane? What did you appreciate about it?
Well, it was a jet, and we had a jet squadron early, the FJ-1s, VF-51, which was a forerunner of the F-86. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work out especially well to where the Navy decided to go wholly into jets, but then as time moved on, we did, and the Panther was one of the very first of a line of jet aircraft. I was originally assigned to a Corsair squadron, being qualified in it, but when I saw the Panthers over there, I learned the name of the commanding officer. It was a guy I knew back at the University of Minnesota. So I sought his help, and he got me transferred to his squadron.
So your airspeed and your horsepower increased a little bit, going from the prop to the jet, and getting back to November of 1952. So you're flying this F-9F. That's a jet aircraft. But the Soviets, of course, have the MiG fighters in the air as well. Pick it up where you left off before I interrupted you.
Well, I came back, and they always maintain a combat air patrol over the task force. Well, I had had a cold, and I had fewer flights recently, so I was tabbed to take the next one. I went as a part of a four-plane Panther flight, and the weather was lousy, 400 feet base of the clouds. Terrible winds and driving snow. We launched, catapult launch off the Oriskany, our carrier, and formed up below the clouds, climbed through them, and on top we saw the incoming contrails of a warning, heads up, that we'd gotten from our combat information center that there were bogies, unidentified aircraft, inbound. And so when we popped through the clouds, we saw them. I saw them anyway. At that point, the flight leader, who was senior to me, had a problem with his airplane, and he was told to take his wingman and remain over the task force. And I took the lead of the flight with my wingman, the guy I had never flown with before, and pursued the, well, I, as they flew over the top of me, and they were at extreme altitude and all giving contrails, that smoke trail behind them, cloud trail, I identified them as MiGs, and they said, that's your target. When they flew over me, they reversed course and headed north, so I flew in that direction, getting further and further behind them, but climbing. And when they got to 26,000 feet, they split in two groups, 103 and 104, and turned in different directions, either to bracket me or decide to go and land or something. But I lost sight of them at that point. And so did the radar operator. So they gave me a command to come back and establish a barricade between the last sighting and the location of the task force. And in that turn, there came four of them in, and they were all shooting at us. And they missed, and as they went by, I kicked in a lot of rudder and wrapped the airplane around and dropped in behind their number four airplane. And with a short burst, he dropped out of the out of the formation and started going down. I didn't know it right then, but my wingman left me and pursued the airplane going down. The others climbed in an amazing way, showing off their greater capability than anything I had.
So I want to understand here. At this point, your wingman has chased the other guy. You've already shot down one of the seven, but now you're up there one on six, and you just said their capability for the MiG was greater than your Panther. So you're one on six with an airplane that's inferior to theirs.
That's correct.
Did that hit you at the time, that the odds were not in your favor?
Well, I didn't plan on this. It was a complete surprise. And I just went on gut tuition and training, and I knew I was in the fight. I was actually told by the controller, do not engage, and I reported that we are engaged. I couldn't just turn tail and run. It wasn't my job, for one thing, and besides that, I probably for sure would have been shot down. So I pursued these three that I already had in sight, and they went high above me and then reversed and came in head on. And so I fired at the first one coming in, and he was shooting way out of range, and I fired where it was about in range, and he broke off, but his wingman came in, and I think I nailed him. He just came straight in and non-maneuvering and passed underneath me. And from then on, they were not formation. They were just taking their turns of the five airplanes left now and attacking. And my job was, I was a fighter pilot, and I knew how to maneuver against a lesser airplane. But the roles had been reversed, and I was now the target with superior numbers and better airplanes coming against me. So I was in a turning defensive fight. And they came in one after another, and I would just do what I could to spoil their aim. As they'd fly by, they did what they should have done, to put their nose up and just pull up, and I would not have the capability to do that with my plane to chase them. But in some cases, they made a mistake, and they went out ahead of me and turned flat, in which case I wrapped the airplane around and was able to get shots at them.
Had you ever had any kind of experience like this before?
Training. But my training was pretty much the role that they were playing against an adversary that was probably a multi-engine slower or something like that, and I was in a more maneuverable airplane and kind of doing what these guys were doing now. But I was a reverse role.
So slowly but surely, over more than 30 minutes, you're picking off one plane at a time. 35 minutes engaged with seven MiGs in this dogfight. How long did it feel like? Did it feel like longer than 35 minutes?
No, the time was sort of compressed. I was just busy, and there was no time to just look around. I was doing a lot of looking, but then I'd see a guy on my tail, and I had to counter him, and then the next guy, and just went on and on until I finally I'd shot down another new because I could see the parts fly off him, and I had to pull the airplane around to avoid hitting pieces of the airplane. Then I had another one smoking, and I was trying to pursue him when I saw a MiG come in on my tail, and then trying to avoid him, he hit me with a 37 millimeter right on the vital part of the airplane and went through the wing and into the accessory section of the engine, and it just wiped out. I had cables to the rudder were shot away, and all the hydraulics were gone, and I basically just had an elevator as a control available to me. And he settled in behind me. I was out of ammunition at this point anyway.
So you're out of ammunition, and your plane's not working right.
Right. It was way out of trim and hard to fly. So I was using two hands on the control stick and heading toward the clouds. And this guy settled in right behind me at a perfect firing range. And he was just shooting. I could see both the 23 millimeter and the 37 fly over me and under me as I was pushing over and pulling back and upsetting his aim. So he wasn't getting to me, and I got in the clouds and he lost sight of me. And I headed back to the task force.
And you're describing this story. You lived it. You've told this story a few times. Maybe it's... It's not
recently, because I was not permitted to talk about it. So 50-some years went by before I told anybody, and that included my brother or my wife or anyone.
Because this engagement was not to have occurred between American fighters and Soviet fighters?
Well, I suppose that was part of it, but I was told it was because this was the first engagement of a new authority and capability, NSA. Everybody knows it today, but this was its first operational mission. And it was aboard a cruiser, the Helena, right off Vladivostok. And with their sophistication and language capability, they had these guys from the time they took off from the field, the Soviet Army Air Force, and through the engagement, and they said until the remnant came back. And so they didn't want to disclose that we had something new in this capability.
Mm-hmm. So that was the first operational mission?
For the NSA operational group, the people that were on the special mission on this cruiser that were monitoring the Soviets.
Got it.
And they had the total picture of what happened. Mm-hmm. And they're the only reason that I knew how many airplanes I shot down. Other than that, I'd see hits and that sort of thing, but I didn't know how many actually were shot down.
You're just trying to survive. You're not keeping score.
That's right. So I didn't know. I have flash remembrances of a lot of it that all pales in, but later on after the Cold War, the Soviets, now the Russians, released the information, and I have the names of the four Soviet pilots that were shot down.
Is that a sobering thought to look at those names?
Yes it is. Yeah.
But if those four weren't shot down, you would have been, in almost certainty, right? And you probably should have been.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'd say if God wasn't on my side, I'd be in the bottom of the ocean off Vladivostok.
Well, and really, I mean, we think about that. Here you've got, you know, you're outnumbered 7-1. They've got better airplanes. And then your plane is disabled and out of ammunition, and there's a guy right on your tail. In those moments, did you think that was it? Did you think there was any way you were going to escape that and survive?
Thinking is an odd thing to say, but I was just busy doing what I was doing, and I don't know, I suppose hope was built in, but I was just totally involved in doing the best I could. And I probably had an adrenaline high and shock after I landed, which was a feat in itself. But then I was talking to the chaplain later toward evening, and that's about the time it set in.
I imagine so, and you said something a moment ago that you had God on your side, and maybe the landing is one of these moments, but what are the moments along that way where you look back and say, yeah, God must have been looking out for me?
There's no doubt. It's sort of like David and seven Goliaths.
That puts it in perspective, doesn't it? It's time for our final break, but more from Medal of Honor recipient Royce Williams when we come back, as well as more highlights from that special ceremony at the Pentagon. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. March 10th is coming soon, and that's when the new World War II book, The Dangerous Shore, hits the shelves. Here's Sarah Vladek, author of the New York Times bestseller Indianapolis, on what makes this new book so unique.
What I tried to do with this story is really take you through the eyes of those individuals who were pivotal in fighting the war on our shores. And they're everyday people. They're not these, you know, war heroes. They're the super nerdy, half-blind scientists, and the, you know, the woman who's a double agent spy, and the mafia. I mean, the mafia played a huge part. We had no attacks in New York, and we had no union or labor strikes because of the mob, and they worked directly with naval intelligence.
Learn about some of the unsung and under-the-radar heroes of World War II and put yourselves in their shoes in The Dangerous Shore by Sarah Vladek. It won't reach shelves till March the 10th, but you can pre-order right now on Amazon.com. Just search for The Dangerous Shore.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode dedicated to Royce Williams after he was awarded the Medal of Honor this week. More than 73 years after his mind-blowing, against-all-odds exploits in his F-9F Panther during the Korean War. Before we jump back into his own words, let's listen to what our nation's current Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Darrell Cottle, had to say at the Hall of Heroes ceremony in the Pentagon.
It is the honor of my lifetime to be with you today. Captain Williams, thank you for allowing us to be part of your story. And sir, might I add that those service dress blues haven't aged you a bit, and I suspect you'd rather be in your flight suit if I know you. What a great Navy day to be here in the Pentagon, and even a better day for our country. We don't often gather in this room for its intended purpose, to honor our heroes. Today, we do. To the rest of the audience, take a moment and look around you. More than 3,500 names are engraved on these walls. They're the names of Americans who on the surface may have seemed like ordinary men, yet whose actions proved anything but. Patriots who answered the nation's call, who did extraordinary things against extraordinary odds, not for recognition, but because it was their solemn duty to do so. Thomas Hudner, Michael Murphy, James Stockdale, Michael Munsoor, and James E. Williams are all but a few of the Navy heroes you'll find on these walls. And today, ladies and gentlemen, we have the privilege of adding one more name, Captain Royce Williams. 74 years ago, under the veils of secrecy and the shadows of a classified Cold War, Captain Williams' actions over the bordering seas of Korea were kept hidden from sight. That is why we are here, because today his record stands corrected. His actions in November of 1952 speak for themselves. Launching from the catapults of the USS Oriskany, Lieutenant Junior Grade Williams and his section of fighters took to the skies on a seemingly benign patrol. Shortly after, his patrol was interrupted by a transmission from combat. From the radio, they barked orders to intercept a flight of incoming bogeys. Mechanical failures in his wingman's planes forced them to return back to base. But Williams pressed on, confronting a fearsome section of enemy MiGs all on his own. What ensued would be the dogfight that we can barely comprehend. Seven Soviet MiGs versus one Navy pilot. Compared to the Grumman Panther, these MiGs were the most advanced Soviet fighters of their time, virtually unbeatable, or so they had thought. Outnumbered, outgunned, but never outmatched, Williams engaged in the fight for his life. What followed would become the longest recorded Navy dogfight to date. 35 minutes of combat, 35 minutes of adrenaline-fueled survival, and 35 minutes of American-made steel and his South Dakota wits. Though the Soviet MiGs were superior in capability, Williams' Panther provided him with an advantage. Sure, they were fast, faster than the speed of sound, but dogfights don't happen at supersonic speeds. They happen in the realm of subsonic. And in that domain, the Grumman Panther was better, more maneuverable, more nimble, and better suited to evade. Guns blazing from seven incoming planes, Williams rolled in to engage. He exercised trigger control, sparing every precious round, ensuring that every bogey hit was struck with precision. One MiG fell, then another, and then another, and then another. From his cockpit, Royce watched on as four Soviet MiGs trailed in flames toward the icy waters below. His Panther riddled with bullets and severe damage to the control, Royce's airplane was Winchester, completely out of ammo and time to go home. White knuckles, nerves of steel, and mastery in his trade were the only things keeping him from pitching flight deck onto the Oriskany and into the frigid Sea of Japan. In those extreme temperatures, ejecting would surely be the end, so it just wasn't an option he would entertain. Coming in hot, no flaps to slow him down, Royce's tail hook snagged a third wire. He had accomplished the unimaginable, safely landing on deck. Jumping out of the cockpit, quickly inspected his plane to see 263 bullet holes had found his plane, but none of them had found him. Today is more than just recognition, it's about restoration. For decades, Captain Williams' bravery remained largely unseen. The strategic realities of the Cold War demanded his silence. Reassured by President-elect Eisenhower, the full measure of Captain Williams' heroism was only known to a few. It wouldn't be until over 50 years later that the events of the cold, blustery November day would officially come to light. In that time, Royce never sought recognition. He never asked for attention. He simply continued to serve quietly, professionally, and with the humility that defines our very best. Today, that record stands corrected. Today, we ensure that future generations of sailors and Americans who will know his name and understand what it represents. Because the story of Captain Royce Williams isn't just about the time served over Korea. It's about a lifetime defined by our Navy Corps values of honor, courage, and commitment. That is the legacy we carry forward. Captain Williams, on behalf of a grateful nation, a grateful Navy, and we salute you, sir. Thank you for your lifetime of service. Thank you for reminding us all what it means to answer our nation's call. Bravo Zulu, shipmate, and welcome to the Hall of Heroes.
Again, that was Admiral Darrell Cottle, Chief of Naval Operations. Now let's get back to Royce Williams' own words. Even after shooting down those four MiGs, he still had more odds to beat. He needed to land that F-9F Panther with all of those holes and very little of what he was used to.
About the landing, you said you had the elevator and that was it. You've got no rudder. Your plane is damaged. Obviously, you're out of ammunition. You can't defend yourself. Where did you have to bring it down, and how did that all unfold?
Well, I was now being guided to the task force by the Combat Information Center controller, and I, on my own, flew on down. I knew the base of the clouds were 400 feet, so I just settled down under it. And I was thinking all along that something might just really go wrong and I'm going to have to eject out of the airplane. But once I got below 1,200 feet, I didn't have the capability to eject safely anymore, so I was pretty much committed, either that or ditch the airplane. But in the terrible storm that was going on, I would not have survived that. Besides, this was November, and the temperature of the water was so low, even though I was in an immersion suit, I probably wouldn't survive more than 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I was committed, and I had to use emergency systems to get the tail hook down and the landing gear down, and I didn't know what speed I could fly it, so I was testing it while I had time, and I found that below 170 knots, that's probably about 190 miles an hour, the airplane would stall, and I had to come in hot much faster than we normally do. But I couldn't guide the airplane to be exacting as required for a carrier landing. Incidentally, I was shot at by our own ships when I came in because they were at ready to fight. There was the battle was on for them, and I hadn't been identified as a friendly, but that was brief.
Just what you need after everything you've been through, seven MiGs shooting at you, and then your guys are shooting at you.
Yeah. And I couldn't line up with the carrier. I got pointed at it when it was into the wind, but I couldn't. This was a straight deck before we went to angle decks, so I had to line up right on down the deck, and I couldn't do it. I could aim at the airplane, but I probably would have just, if I hit the airplane, the deck at all, probably bounced off and gone over the side. But the commanding officer of the ship at the last moment turned it and lined it up with me, and I ended up with more or less a normal landing.
More or less a normal landing after all that.
Yeah.
And then you said afterwards is when it really sank in for you. Have you ever met another pilot who shot down four Russian planes in a day?
There aren't any American pilots who have shot down four jets ever on one mission.
You're the only one?
Only one. The Air Force, in its total commitment to fighting the MiGs with an F-86 Sabre, equal or better airplane in some regards. And the most they ever shot down in one mission was two. And this is after they've been fighting him and fighting him and into all kinds of experience. And there were six of them that got two in one mission out of all that. And it wasn't their first mission by far.
So here, you're the only pilot that's ever done what you've done, but you have to keep it a secret for a half century. Was that difficult or no big deal for you?
I learned to live with it. And it was initially because in our squadron, we have camaraderie and so forth, and we're all busy fighting the war, and we're going back to doing the defense of our troops and so forth. And I never talked about it because when I was cautioned not to say what I knew, the only way I could avoid it was just don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't. You know, and it was kind of hard being in there, it being sort of a centerpiece of our deployment, and hush, hush. You know, people kind of look at me strangely and say, I guess, you know, why is he so closed-mouthed?
And how long did you stay in the Navy?
Well, I went on a physical disability retirement in 1970, late 75, almost 76. And then I got recalled. I eventually got my regular retirement in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
It was 1942 stint with Minnesota Guard. And then from 43 to 80 in the Navy. And then after I retired, I got recalled one more time to go out as a commodore of a task force for training.
During the Vietnam War, what were you up to?
I was a wing commander on the Kitty Hawk. I was flying F-4 Phantoms and A-4 Skyhawks.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of interesting experiences there as well. And the second tour, because of injuries and stuff I had from a plane crash one time, they limited me from some of the medications they were authorized, and going from 5.5 grains of thyroid a day down to none, I was losing my hair and tired. And when they realized the mistake and that, they sent me orders that you're authorized for command at sea, in combat, in naval aircraft, in command, but not at the actual controls. So I got myself in the school for naval flight officers and went back as a wing commander in the back seat.
You nonchalantly mentioned injuries from a plane crash. Mm-hmm. Most people don't have that experience. Have you had more than one of those experiences, or what's the one you're referring to?
No, the only one that I really crashed, I've had some Very interesting. I brought one airplane back with Phantom with both engines on fire and loss of power. I had to land an afterburner, which was only one of the kind. But the Phantom was flown around the world by the British and the Aussies and a lot of Americans, and they'd lost 16 airplanes in a row to a double engine fire. And here it happened to me. But they'd always bailed out. I had my backseater eject, but I brought the airplane back, and they found out what caused it and corrected it, and we had no more of that.
And what were the extent of your injuries?
Well, I have 11 vertebrae that aren't right.
Only 11?
Yeah.
So you had your backseater, as you said, eject.
Yes.
You stayed with the airplane just because you thought, hey, if anyone can pull this off, I can, or what?
No, it was because my training... As long as it's flying and I'm able to command it, I stayed with it. I still had the option. If something suddenly happened, I could eject. I didn't want it endangering hospitals and schools and all of that, so I just drove it till I got back aboard the base.
So you started flying as a pilot in World War II, Korea, the Cold War, the Vietnam War. In all that time, did you have a favorite aircraft you flew?
I did much the propeller airplane, the F-8 Bearcat. It had so much power that it was stunning. And then the next thing was in the jets with afterburners. And one of the most exciting airplanes I flew was the F-8 Crusader.
I guess another thing comes to mind, that the perspective that you have on all these conflicts and the men that you served with through, you know, parts of five different decades in the Navy. What are you most proud of, and what are you most thankful for?
Well, I had my sights set on this thing as a kid. It's what I wanted to do, and I guess I'm pretty happy that I did it.
Well, thank you for serving our country, sir. Thank you for telling us a story that wasn't told for a long time and that only you can tell. I got to ask you about this group here, the Old Bold Pilots. What about these gentlemen gets you excited to come?
Well, I guess the legacy, we've all been pretty much through the same thing.
In light of everything you've experienced, and you've seen the world at some very tense moments, is there anything that, as we look ahead and try to learn lessons from our past, that with all your insight and personal experience, you would like to pass on?
I've seen an awfully lot of change from a kid on the prairie in Dakotas, where it was pretty much horse and buggy, especially in the wintertime.
Huh.
To where we have all this electronic stuff, including warfare now. It hasn't changed the world much. There are always wars. There's always danger. It's fought differently. It's just as dangerous. And we depend on good leadership.
Something we can all hope and pray our military has in the future. The one and only Royce Williams. And how surreal to meet him when the government had never formally acknowledged his heroics. And now a decade later, to see him awarded the Medal of Honor. That's all the time we have today. But thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver. At ProvidentPayments.com.